It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out why junk calls and robocalls are seemingly out of control and what, if anything, we can do about it.
First, Democratic leaders from around Wisconsin gathered in Green Bay for their annual convention this weekend. The convention takes place at a time when there are still two candidates in the primaries still battling for the party's presidential nomination.
But the party's own candidates weren't the sole focus. There was plenty of talk about presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump and a proposal to do away with superdelegates.
J.R. Ross joins us now. He's editor for WisPolitics.com. He covered the convention this weekend. J.R., welcome back to the show.
Thanks. How are you guys doing today?
Well, good. So let's start on the Democratic side of things. Two candidates. It's been contentious among many Democrats. Was there a lot of talk about the Sanders-Clinton race in this convention?
Well, a little bit. What was kind of interesting, though, was that both conventions try to strike a theme of unity, that these parties are unified, ready to go together, go forward to the fall election. It seemed like the Democrats had a little bit easier time putting a happy face on that unity message. That could be for a couple reasons. One, Republicans back in May, they had their convention right after Donald Trump basically sealed the deal. He hadn't got to the needed delegates yet, but it was clear he was going to win. And so there's kind of a certain pall, if you will, over the convention of, okay, this guy who we really fought hard against in Wisconsin, who did poorly here, is going to be the nominee. Now what do we do? Whereas maybe with the Democrats, the race is still not settled. Yes, Hillary Clinton is really close to clinching the nomination between pledged and superdelegates, but the Bernie folks were still kind of striking an optimistic tone of, we still got California and these states on Tuesday. The fight's not over yet. So there was an overt tension. You didn't see here in Wisconsin, in Nevada, for example, where there's a delegate selection process where chairs were thrown or possibly thrown and people were upset and there was yelling. It was a much more calm convention, if you will, a little bit more unified, if you will.
And there was a resolution that would have changed or called for the Democratic Party to change the way its primaries work, get rid of superdelegates, and to advise this year superdelegates to vote in line with a proportion of the Wisconsin Party. How did that end up coming out?
Well, Keith, remember, these are both non-binding resolutions.
Right.
So even though they passed them, there's not a lot of weight behind it. It does, though, represent kind of where the base is at for Democrats. And, oh, by the way, the Clinton folks weren't real unhappy about this. They said, look, if that's what people want, great, let them knock it out, and we're okay with it because, by the way, they're winning with pledged delegates. They're okay with this. But bottom line is the base of the Democratic Party, people who are activists who showed up at a convention, they want to do away with the superdelegate process after this election by 2020, have it gone. The resolution puts the party on record saying we are encouraging the end of the superdelegate system. Another one encouraged the 10 superdelegates that we have to get together and collectively cast their ballots 6-4 for Sanders. Now, remember, he won Wisconsin in the April primary with about 56.6% of the vote among Democrats. So if you were to do a proportional, proportionally for superdelegates, he'd get 6. Right now, 6 are backing Clinton, 1's backing Sanders, and 3 are uncommitted. So it's the opposite. Again, non-binding, but it kind of sends a message to the superdelegates of, we would like you to do this. And in talking to people who are pushing this, the idea was, there are some elected officials who are among the folks who are superdelegates. If they don't do this, we'll remember this come election time, they're on the ballot again.
Now, that's talking about their own party. Was there a lot of talk, and I know there were a lot of speakers, people running for office, some national Democratic figures. How much talk was there of the rival candidate, Donald Trump?
Oh, a lot. The running joke of the convention was that Democrats were talking more about Donald Trump than Republicans did at their convention in May, which is true. If you sat through the speeches in May in Green Bay, most Republicans kind of avoided talking about him at all. Governor Walker didn't talk about him. He's focused on Ron Johnson, for example. You had more of the congressional delegation, folks like Sean Duffy and Jim Sensenbrenner, Glenn Grothman, they talked about Trump. The Democrats, though, almost every single person brought Trump up, and it was like a rallying cry. They see him as a real weight around the necks of Republicans. And, oh, by the way, yes, Democrats have this division right now with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders supporters, but a good way to rally people back around the cause is to point out that, hey, the alternative is Donald Trump is president. Do you want that? They're counting that being a motivating factor for these folks to kind of get past whatever hurt feelings they have after Tuesday and rally against Donald Trump come fall.
We're talking to J.R. Ross from WisPolitics.com about this weekend's Democratic State Convention in Green Bay. Let's take a look at some of these down-ballot races, still pretty high up there. The race for the U.S. Senate, a rematch between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold. What did you hear from former Senator Feingold when he spoke at the convention?
He spoke last year's convention as well, a little sharper this year about Ron Johnson, a little bit more energetic, kind of more on talking about, he had an issue with Ron Johnson, for example, with what he calls dark money ads. These are super PACs are coming in running ads going after former Senator Feingold. Took an issue with that. Now, of course, the Johnson folks point back, well, look, the League of Conservation Voters has been running ads against Ron Johnson. What's the difference? So Feingold's answer is, well, these groups backing Johnson are run by his former supporters, and it's a much different thing in his mind, at least. So there's a lot of talk about this race coming up this fall, and Feingold kind of laid out a little bit of his agenda, talking about what he heard on the trail. He's been visiting all 72 counties. So he heard about being broadband, about wanting that in all the communities in Wisconsin, about things like that. Though he talked about what he heard and what he's going to do if he gets sent back to the Senate.
And how about races for Congress? Now, the way Wisconsin works, for the most part, it's about a few safe Democratic seats, bunch of safe Republican ones. And then Reed Ribble's seat in that area, the Green Bay area, he's leaving. He was one Republican who still hasn't endorsed Donald Trump. Was there a lot of focus on that particular race, which is probably the most contested in the state?
Yeah, Tom Nelson is the county executive from up that area who is running for that seat. He spoke to the convention on Friday night. So some attention that way, but it wasn't like an overwhelming focus on that seat. I do get the impression from talking to Democrats that they believe that if Donald Trump ends up being a big weight around Republicans, that makes it all the better for them to win that seat. Tom Nelson is viewed as a hard worker, is going to raise a decent amount of money for a Democrat to run for that seat. They feel very good about the chances, especially, again, if Donald Trump, and the dynamic has changed a little bit in the last week. If you look at kind of a couple weeks ago, Republicans are like, well, we're feeling better about Donald Trump. It maybe won't be as bad as he thought it was going to be. He's being a little more focused. But then the whole judge comments that Thursday, I think last week or Friday, that's kind of flipped it back again to an, oh, no, what are we doing kind of feeling. And if that Donald Trump, the Trump of going after this judge who was born in Indiana and referring to him as Mexican, if that's the Donald Trump we're going to see between now and November, Dems feel very good about the environment for a Tom Nelson to run in the 8th Congressional District.
Yeah, was there a lot of talk about Democrats having a chance of retaking the U.S. Senate or even the House of Representatives with, as they view it, the help of Donald Trump?
The U.S. Senate, yes. The House, there wasn't a lot of conversation about the House. That's a much bigger hill to climb, a lot more seats. Same with the state level in Wisconsin. It is a hill to climb for Democrats right now to take back both houses or even the Senate. But in the right environment, they feel like, if the right mistakes are made by Donald Trump, maybe. But it's still a bit of a hill to climb.
These are party insiders for the most part. Are they talking about the state legislature much, or are these marquee races, President, U.S. Senate, kind of taking all the air out of the room for local politics?
The clear focus is on the presidential race, Senate race, the 8th. Remember, there also were elections this weekend for members of the Democratic National Committee. The legislative races are just getting settled now because the filing deadline was Wednesday of last week. So they're just getting candidates kind of introduced and locked in. But part of this is all about getting the energy built up. I mean, these are kind of almost like rallies where the people who attend, they're the ones who man the phone banks on the weekends and make calls to you saying, hey, are you turning out to vote in November? If you're not, can we get you out there? What are your concerns? Can you support this person? They're the ones who put yard signs up. They're the ones who write the checks. They're the ones who really get involved and drive the turnout operation. So it's kind of like a rally for those folks to get them re-energized of like, okay, we got, 5 months to go, whatever it is. Let's make sure we're on task and locked in that we're ready for November. That's a big part of what these conventions are like in election years.
JR, as we wrap up, you've been to both parties' conventions now, both in Green Bay. You've seen both of the rallies, heard the speeches on both sides. Any indicator, any foreshadowing of what we're going to be in for the next, what is it now, 5 months until Election Day?
I tell people that when I do things like this or go on TV or things I write, it's all based off of what I hear from operatives, people who run campaigns, who I've trusted and have known for years, who can kind of give me a feel of what's happening. I feel less confident about what I hear now than I ever have, not because these guys have suddenly become less smart, but because we've never seen an environment like this. You're talking about two candidates who are really disliked, especially with Donald Trump. It's hard to predict. The fall could be a wipeout for Republicans. It could be Donald Trump shocks the world. I mean, it's really this feeling of we just don't know. It's nothing like I've ever seen before and may never see again in my career.
Uncharted territory. JR, thanks for helping us navigate it.
Hey, anytime. Take care.
That's JR Ross, editor for WisPolitics.com. He talked to us about this weekend's Democratic Party convention in Green Bay.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Social Security is a key part of retirement planning for many Americans, but there are some important decisions to make before retiring. A guest shares advice and strategies to help make Social Security work for you.
First, is it just us or are junk phone calls getting kind of out of control these days? Well, it seems like a lot of the times when the phone rings, you've got a telemarketer, a scammer, maybe the dreaded Rachel from Card Services on the other end. It's enough to make people just not want to answer the phone anymore.
Wasn't supposed to be like this. Back in 2003, the U.S. government created the Do Not Call Registry, a magical database we could add our phone number to, and in theory, never be bothered again. So what happened? How are more and more of these calls getting through? And what, if anything, can we do about it?
Helene Olin joins us now. She's a columnist for Slate, where she recently wrote about the issue. She's also the co-author of The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. Helene, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So first of all, are we crazy or does it really seem like there are more of these robocalls and junk calls than there used to be?
We are not crazy, and this is all but out of control. To give you some perspective on this, last year, the Federal Trade Commission received 3 million complaints about telemarketers. That's triple the number in 2009. If you think that sounds bad, try this year, where they're on track to have more than 5 million complaints by the end of the year.
So when you say complaints, what are people saying? Just that they're bothered, or are people losing real money?
Both is the answer. Some people are saying they are bothered and they want it to stop, and they're wondering why the Do Not Call list is not being enforced. And we can come back to that in a second. And others are actually losing money. I mean, I think we all know these scams are horrendous. There's everything from, you know, there's a fake Marriott International scam. It's not Marriott, by the way. I put that in my article, actually. There's an Internal Revenue scam. There's a computer virus scam. There's Rachel from Cardholder Services. But to take one example alone, the IRS scam cost consumers almost $30 million last year.
That's serious money when you take it cumulatively. So you got to wonder what's going on that it's gotten this out of control.
Right. And so I began to look at it because I have to admit I was just curious, too. I wanted to know why the government had stopped enforcing the Do Not Call list. And as it turned out, that wasn't the problem at all. The government is actually still quite interested in the Do Not Call list. The issue is that the technology, the advances in phone technology, have essentially rendered the Do Not Call list ineffective. So the issue is, why aren't the phone companies helping us out?
Do most people think what you thought initially, that it was the government asleep at the wheel here?
That's what it seems like. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, no one has actually gone out there and surveyed it. But I think if you would just randomly stop 20 people on the street or ask 20 of your friends what they think is going on, you will get rants about the Do Not Call list. I went into comment sections of articles about this going back years, and you would see people blaming the government over and over again for the calls that are bothering them. I quoted a few of them in my article. And it would be, people would say things like, you know, like anything about the government, totally worthless. Someone else wrote back, you have that right. Another person wrote, this is yet another example of your tax dollars hard at work. Another government failure. I mean, it just went on and on and on.
So people are really ticked off at the government, but it sounds like you're saying the technology has just advanced such that the Do Not Call list isn't really working the way that it used to work. So what can the technology do now that renders it above and beyond what the Do Not Call list can do?
Right. Well, I should backtrack for one second and explain what happened, which is the Do Not Call list comes in 2003, and while it's never perfect, for several years, as we all know, it's working pretty, pretty well, roughly till about 2009, 2010, when you see the complaints start to soar again. And what essentially happened is that the same voice over internet technology, we're talking about the same technology that eliminated your long-distance phone bill that we all love so much, right? We no longer get long-distance phone bills. also permitted bad actors to set up shop outside the United States and blast us with calls using spoofing technology, disguising where the phone number was coming from. And when the government tried to crack down, as we all know, it's very hard to enforce fines and other penalties from people where you're not even sure where they are, who they are and where they are. And if by chance you find them, they turn out to be in Russia or India or Bangladesh or Peru or fill in the blank here.
Right. So now it sounds like these bad actors, as you call them, can do a phony call from the IRS, say, but it looks like it's coming from Washington, D.C. So you might think, oh, maybe this really is the IRS.
Right. And the IRS scam was notorious for that. And the Microsoft scam, which was somebody calling about a fake computer problem, was showing the area code for Redmond, Washington, which is where Microsoft is headquartered. And there's really not a lot the government can do about this. They have fined organizations up one side and down the other, and they've collected less than 10%. So the issue is the phone companies, and it turns out there's actually a lot they can do, but they're not doing.
We're talking about the problem of soaring rates of robocalls and junk calls with Helene Olin right now. She's a columnist for Slate, where she wrote about the problem. And Helene, I guess the question is, does the technology exist to stop it now?
Yes, and it depends, and it's different technology depending on, you know, what kind of line you're on. But for instance, if you are on a voice over internet line, which is, say, a Fios Verizon line, like I am on right now, you could simply put something called No More Robo on your phone, which is a technology invented, or created, I should say, by someone who was responding to a contest sponsored by the federal government back in 2013. And essentially, it figures out which numbers are commonly spoofed and then blocks them. Your phone might ring once. This sounds wonderful, right? So what's the problem? Well, if you're a customer of Time Warner, you're really lucky. They have a one-step sign-up process for this now. They offer it up for free. If you're a customer of, say, Verizon, like me, you have to go through a multi-step process and hope it works. If you're a customer of AT&T, good luck to you. AT&T is claiming the federal government is not giving them the permission to stop robocalls, which, by the way, is so not true. The Federal Communications Commission last year actually explicitly gave phone companies the permission to stop robocalls because their phone companies had claimed for a long time that they couldn't do it because they could potentially block, like, say, emergency weather calls as well.
So what's up with that? Why are some of these telecom companies dragging their feet on it?
Well, part of it is this probably costs some money, especially with landlines, where there's technology that has to be upgraded. And frankly, while we can't, like, say, prove this, AT&T, for example, is offering up a service where they will block up to 10 calls, 10 numbers for you, for the price of, I believe, it's $8.50 a month.
So is anybody in Washington looking to do anything about this to either get the telecoms a little more sanguine about their backing of this or working on anything else in this vein?
Yes, they are. Jackie Speier, who's a congresswoman from Northern California and a known longtime consumer advocate, I should say, recently introduced legislation that would demand the phone companies act within 18 months of it being passed. Just this week, Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, offered a similar bill in the Senate.
And looking at that AT&T option where you can pay $8.50 and have 10 numbers blocked, is that enough? Do you have any idea, Helene, how many numbers we would need to block for this to be effective?
Well, let me put it to you this way. Do you think it would be effective?
I'm guessing no.
I think we've all gotten a lot more than 8 or 10 calls of these a month. It also doesn't help that a number of them come with private caller. That was mine this afternoon, actually. I got a computer technology one while I was waiting for this to do this interview. It was a private caller.
Is there anything that consumers can do proactively on their end to either do a roundabout on the telecoms or anything else that might help?
Well, if your company allows you to upload a program like No More Robo, and there's a couple of others like it as well, I would certainly advise it. But again, that really depends on your company. Truthfully, I think the most effective thing would be to lobby Washington to get these bills passed so that the government, so that the phone companies are actually forced to act. I tend to think relying on several hundred million people to upgrade their own phone lines that they might or might not actually be able to do is not exactly the most effective way to go.
Now, is this a problem across the board? It seems like this is an issue that affects landlines more than it affects cells.
Well, it's illegal to call a cell, but it's becoming an increasing problem for cell phones, too. And, again, you're falling into the same trap. It depends on who the carrier is, who the phone, what kind of phone it is. There's more apps on Android to block these things than on Apple for some reason. And it is becoming an increasing problem for cells as well.
You talk a little bit in your piece about the cost of letting the government kind of take the fall for the blame on this one. Do you think, what is the cost?
This is where I really started the article, was I think the cost is people get very cynical about the government and what it can and can't do. And in this case, what seems to be going on is people are actually blaming the government for ignoring their woes, not realizing that the problem is emanating not from the government, which is actually frantically trying to do something about this, but the private telecom companies who are not particularly acting accountable to their customers.
So we're back to your point here. Lobby your phone company.
Lobby your phone company. Lobby your senator or congressman. If you can, and this is a real issue for you, consider switching. If enough people switched their lines to somebody who was offering more help, it might actually cause some movement.
And in this case, you said that was Time Warner.
Time Warner is probably one of the best ones. There's others, too, but that's the one I believe most consumer advocates say is doing quite a bit at this point.
Helene, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
That was Slate columnist Helene Olin, and she joined us to talk about why junk calls and robocalls are out of control and what we might be able to do about it.
Coming up after the news, our guest shares advice on making the most of your Social Security benefits. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll look at Muhammad Ali's legacy and how issues of race define his life and his career.
First, Social Security can be a key part of the budget for life after retirement or for people receiving Social Security disability benefits. But there can be tough decisions to make about how and when to claim benefits, and it's not always easy to see a clear answer, especially after some recent rule changes.
In her new book, our next guest shares the history and goals of Social Security and lays out some of the most important decisions for you to make about it. And you can join in now with your questions at 800-642-1234. Are you planning your retirement now? How does Social Security fit into your plans? What are you trying to figure out how to do, and what has you confused? You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Finance writer Emily Guy Birkin joins us now. Her newest book is Making Social Security Work for You. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, you write that it's important to understand the history and the intent of Social Security to get into the right mindset in a way of how to use it. So in a nutshell, what was the goal of Social Security?
Well, Social Security has its roots in the Great Depression, when many people, and particularly elderly, were living in just abject poverty. And at the time, there were many different socialized programs, social insurance programs that were put forth as options for helping to create a safety net for the elderly poor. And Franklin D. Roosevelt decided to create Social Security in order to, for one thing, it was a savvy political move to, he didn't want another candidate to swoop in with a better system. He wanted to have one in place to give to voters. And then partially just because people were suffering so poorly during that the Great Depression, as I'm sure we all know. But that's the basis of it. The idea behind it is that it's a social safety net. It's never been intended as a retirement program exactly.
And some people think of it maybe synonymously with a retirement program, maybe as a sort of investment because you've been paying into the system for a long time. That's not really, you're right, the way to think about it.
Oh, no, no. It's a common way of thinking of it, and it's an understandable one. Very much like a 401k or an IRA, you contribute money to Social Security while you're working. And so it would be understandable to think of it as, okay, so where's my money when I retire? But that is not how it works, and it's never been how it works. It's always been treated as a direct transfer from current workers to current beneficiaries. So at no point was it ever, you know, your money is being earmarked from every paycheck in an account with your name on it. It's you have to trust that once you get to retirement, the current workers at that time will be paying for your benefits.
Well, and that takes us into the future of Social Security. A lot of people worry about that Social Security is doomed, maybe in the short run, maybe in the middle run. Is it?
No. The thing that there are things to be concerned about for Social Security. The trust fund will be depleted in the 2030s, so in about two decades. And that's something that can make you feel a little panicked. However, the trust fund is only one of the source of income for Social Security. Otherwise, we're talking about that direct transfer, so the taxes that are taken from current workers. There is the amount of interest that is earned on money that is in the trust fund, and then the trust fund itself. So now that's not to say that it's not a problem that the trust fund is going to be depleted in the next two decades, but we are the only country that does a 75-year projection of our social insurance program. No other country in the world does it. So that means that we're in a unique position to actually affect change in time. So it's a little bit scary to see this, but the fact is we are always planning ahead and looking forward. The problem is Social Security is such a political football that it is, they call it the third rail of politics. You don't want to touch it. but the fact is we will do things to fix it. They may want to, you know, give us heart attacks before we get there, but our government is not going to avoid these problems indefinitely.
Talking to Emily Guy-Birkin. She's the author of the new book, Making Social Security Work for You. Emily, we've been talking big picture now. I want to talk about how Social Security affects us, how we can make some decisions. One big thing you write changed in Social Security recently enough that you actually had to go back and rewrite a decent chunk of the book so that you were keeping up. What changed last year?
In October, they made a change as a part of the new budget. They made a change that will eliminate the file and suspend strategy and restricted application. And so file and suspend was a strategy that allowed beneficiaries to, upon reaching their full retirement age, which for anyone who is retiring, who is full retirement age this year is 66, to file for their benefits and immediately suspend them. And that would allow their beneficiaries, so a spouse or children, to still receive the auxiliary benefits based on their benefits, even though they're suspended. That is no longer allowed. That was eliminated as of April 30th of this year, 2016. So they had a six-month phase-in time. And then the restricted application was one of the ways that married couples could really take advantage of file and suspend. When you apply for any Social Security benefit, the Social Security Social Security deems that to be filing for all of your benefits. With the restricted application, You could say, no, I'm just filing for my spousal benefits, or I'm just filing for my retirement benefits, and still allow delayed retirement credits to accrue on, say, your retirement benefits if you're just filing for spousal benefits. And for some couples, this meant as much as $50,000 or $60,000 more overall that they were receiving in benefits. So that right there is the reason why these have been eliminated. The restricted application has a longer phase-out time. Anyone who turned 62 as of January 1st of 2016 can still file a restricted application.
So the idea here was that these were kind of loopholes, almost unintended consequences of previous changes that had an unintended consequence.
Yes, these came from changes from 2000, which were intended to get seniors back to work. And so it took a few years, but people started realizing, hey, this is a loophole, and I could use that to you know, have more benefits between myself and my spouse. And it kind of snowballed over several years. And in addition to it being a loophole, it also kind of created a de facto two-tiered system where wealthier beneficiaries or those who were in the know were able to access that, whereas beneficiaries who earned less were less likely to know about these options. And so it kind of was an unfair system. And so that was another reason why it was eliminated.
One of the biggest questions you hear about Social Security is, when should someone take it? There are options to take it right when you're eligible, or some years later when you're eligible for full benefits. How can someone start weighing that decision?
In general, the longer you wait, the better it is. Now, there are certainly some situations where it might make sense for you to take benefits as soon as you can, which is at age 62. And in those cases, it's generally a matter of, do you need it to keep the lights on? However, if you can any way hold off on taking your benefits, it's going to be better off. Now, people will often think, well, is it really? They'll talk about the break-even point. And you'll see if you take benefits at 62, generally the break-even point shows you have to be 77 before you'd make the same amount lifetime as you would if you take benefits at your full retirement age. The problem is, if you're looking at it that way, you're looking at it as an amount of money that you'll have won, and the only way to win is to die before you reach age 77, which is kind of a grim way to look at things. And second, frankly, when you're talking about poverty in and old age, the worst thing that could happen to you is not dying young. The worst thing that could happen to you is living to be 110 and not having enough money. So it is in your best interest to wait as long as possible so that you can get higher benefit amounts per month, because it goes up about 8% per year that you wait. And then that is permanently what you're going to have, is that higher amount, which will help you as you age.
And some of the advice in your book is finding ways to bridge those few years between initial retirement eligibility and full benefit eligibility by, what, cutting expenses, looking at other means of retirement support?
Yes. For some people, I recommend a reverse mortgage, in fact. One of the things that you'll see, a lot of times they'll talk about a percentage of Americans have less than $25,000 set aside for retirement. I mean, and a lot of people do not have money set aside. But in those studies, it's always excluding their major residence. So, well, let's not exclude the major residence. That is worth something. And if you are smart about it, using a reverse mortgage could potentially be a way that you could afford the wait between your retirement and when you apply for benefits.
We're talking to Emily Guy Birkin about her new book. It's called Making Social Security Work for You.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you starting to plan your retirement or closing in on it? Do you have questions about Social Security and how to use it? And what decisions are you trying to make right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and maybe hear from you in just a minute. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Emily Guy-Birkin. She's the author of Making Social Security Work for You.
You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Are you planning your retirement now? How does Social Security fit into your plans? Are you trying to figure out what to do? What has you confused? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Emily, what are some common misconceptions that people stumble on, maybe give them trouble, make them get less benefit that they would from Social Security than they otherwise would?
Well, one of the biggest misconceptions I see is people seem to think that Social Security is just circling the drain. And so there, a lot of times the thinking is, well, I'll take benefits as early as possible because I don't know how long they'll be there. And that's something that can really bite you if you fall victim to that particular misconception. Yes, there are things to be concerned about, but you don't need to worry that that the benefits will not be there for you. Something will be there for you.
We'll go to our callers now. Helen is on the line in Green Bay. Helen, hi.
Hi, you guys. This is a great program. Emily, I have a question. I've heard that Congress borrows from Social Security, and then there's all the circling the drain comment that you just said. And so I'm wondering, mm-hmm. is it true that Congress has borrowed from Social Security funds, and if they have, will they pay it back?
Thank you. That's a great question. What you're referring to is a Social Security trust fund, and something that is very difficult to wrap our minds around is the trust fund is not a big vault with money in it. The trust fund works the way any investment or savings account works, which is you know that when you put money in the bank as a savings account, the bank is immediately turning around and lending it out to small business owners, among other, you know, and people buying houses. Same thing with when you invest in a company. They are using that money to pay payroll, to pay for their overhead, those sorts of things. And then they pay it back. Now, the Social Security Trust Fund is used in the same way. And it was written into the original document that this is how the money was to be used. If there was surplus, it was to be used with the full faith and standing of the government backing it and would receive 3% interest. That is what's happening. So when you hear that Congress borrows from the trust fund, that's both true and completely untrue. It is true that the money is used. It's used for all the things that government needs to do, paving roads, schools, military, welfare, payroll for government employees, all of those things. But it is used in the same way that a company uses money to earn more money and paid back with interest. So that is something that I personally did not really understand completely until I really did deep research on this, because it's so difficult to get into a soundbite. But that's the thing to remember, is that when our government uses the money from the Social Security Trust Fund, they are using it as responsibly and in the same way that any bank would use money, because it can't just sit in a vault and wait for it to be used for the benefits. It needs to continue to grow, which means it needs to be spent and then brought back after having been spent that way.
Helen, thanks.
I hope that was clear.
I think so, yeah. I think I kind of get it. Helen, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Pam in Onalaska. Pam, hi.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Pam?
I would like to ask about my husband has worked most of his life, and I have too. But he is going to be 62 in October, and I have earned more than he has. And so we're wondering, will he be drawing on his Social Security? Because I've earned more, would he be eligible to draw on my for spousal or on his own? And I will take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Pam, you're welcome.
Pam, thanks for the call. Emily?
So basically how this is going to work is he will always be drawing on his own. Now, whether or not his own will be supplemented with spousal has to do with how large a difference there is. Now, if she has earned more than twice as much as he has, then he will earn some excess spousal benefit the formula is her primary insurance amount, which is the amount that you get at full retirement age, or 50% of her primary insurance amount minus his insurance amount equals his excess spousal benefits. So, for instance, if she were going to get $2,400 as her primary insurance amount and he were going to get $1,000, he would get an excess spousal benefit of $200 because $2,400 divided by 2 is $1,200 minus $1,000 is $200. So then he would be eligible for a $1,200 benefit once he reaches full retirement age. And you can see why these things kind of make your eyes roll back in your head.
Well, Emily, is the intent there, if spouse A is the household primary breadwinner, spouse B isn't, maybe they stayed home for some years, that spouse A doesn't get all the money and spouse B gets no benefit or little benefit? Is that the main goal there?
The goal is to be what's known as actuarially fair, which is not straight down the board exactly fair you pay what you get or exactly fair everyone gets exactly the same amount. It's that it's worth a similar amount of similar percentage to what you earned and your household earned. So that's why there are things like spousal benefits and stuff like that. It's also to try to help families where one spouse out-earned another to kind of meet the distance between those two. I find it similar to the tax code. Every single individual rule makes sense in itself. It's when you put them in aggregate that they start sounding a little crazy.
Talking to Emily Guy-Burkin about Social Security. Her new book is called Making Social Security Work for You. You can join in if you need some advice at 800-642-1234. Interesting bit of advice in your book, Emily, the 35-year rule for working. If we've worked for fewer than 35 years and we're close, might be worth working a few more years, it sounds like.
Yes. Yes. In order to determine what your PIA is, your primary insurance amount, the amount of money that you will get upon reaching your full retirement age, the Social Security Administration calculates your 35 highest earning years. Now, if you've worked less than 35 years, they put in zeros for the years that you didn't work. So that brings down your average for quite a bit. So if you're close to retirement and you've only worked 33 years because you took time off for whatever reason, you got a late start, however it worked out, it's in your best interest to work another 2 years because that will make a huge difference in how much you will get in your monthly benefit check.
Back to our callers now with Marcus in Green Bay. Marcus, hi.
Hello. I was wondering if according to the rumors or whatever, will my Social Security disability income check maybe be canceled with a new administration that might take place?
Marcus, thanks for that call. Disability, a big part of Social Security we haven't gotten to. Is that something that's vulnerable to the slings and arrows of political fortune, Emily?
Yes. Now, I suspect some of what you're talking about is there was a disability shortfall that was slated to occur in October of 2016. It was nearly 20% that was going to affect current beneficiaries. That was averted by the Budget Act of 2015 that also canceled, restricted application and filed suspend. So that's the first aspect of it. The second, there is no reason to believe that Social Security disability is going to be eliminated. Now, that being said, all of this is government statute, which means that it's possible for the government to make changes. The laws change. That's how things work. However, considering the huge number of beneficiaries who are on Social Security disability and how important it is to our economy, I consider it highly unlikely to the point of impossible that any administration would cancel it. There may need to be changes and tweaks to make it affordable. However, the mass chaos that would ensue if all of the disability beneficiaries were suddenly off the rolls, that would be a problem.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call. As we start to wrap up, Emily, make the case that a little bit of homework on Social Security can make a pretty big difference.
It makes a huge difference. As little as another $1,000 per year. So that's over an entire 12-month period, so about $80 a month. As little as that reduces your chance of being in poverty by 1 to 2%. So the more you know, the better able you are to get the full benefit that you are entitled to. And believe me, I truly want people to get their full benefits. You are entitled to that. That is what the law says. So you should work to get the full benefit available to you. And the more that you get, and it's just $1,000 per year, the less likely you are to fall into poverty as you age.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Emily Guy Birkin. She's a finance writer. Her new book is called Making Social Security Work for You. You can share your Social Security advice, maybe your story, at the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, we have a link to Emily Guy Birkin's website. She answers questions there, has advice on personal finance in general, not just on Social Security. Again, you can share your story and find a link to that information. It is all at the Central Time Facebook page. This weekend, I was at a consumer goods store. I'm not going to name names. This is a high tech. You might go there to replace a cell phone or something like that. And they've got speakers there. And the music in the store was really loud to the point of like making it hard to have a conversation. We talked about this.
Right. This has been a hot topic with us. We have producers on staff who say the music is not too loud. We're just too old, which I find hard to believe.
Places like that.
Yeah, at restaurants. But in stores, you kind of wonder what's going on there when the music is that loud. So what did you find?
Well, it was loud until I snuck over to the speaker and turned it down. Take that, store people. But I found online, a researcher says stores are consciously doing things like playing upbeat music to get you to buy more stuff.
Right, and I think the same piece that you're referencing here said fast food restaurants will play really up-tempo music, fast music, so
you
eat fast and you get in and out, right.
Right, but this researcher said if it's too loud, it can drive people off and it's bad news. But what I think is the loud music, it's the pressure, they're trying to upsell you, it's complicated forms, and you panic and you pay too much money.
And did that happen in your case?
It did not because...
because you turned it down yourself?
I was a demanding consumer and I snuck over and turned down their... Well, so take that, the man.
Well done.
All right. I struck a bloke for consumer freedom yet again here on Central Time.